Welcome to Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
It's good to be here, and good to do another show. I'll let you introduce us and get started today.
Okay. I thought this would be a good opportunity for us. We've been doing so much of this Reformation stuff to look at one of the central characters in all of this, and that being the Emperor Charles V. Absolutely fascinating man. There's been a number of biographies on him. Probably the most scholarly is a German work by Karl Brandi, and it's simply called Charles V. It's been translated into English, and it's a very thick, typically German historic tome, but very, very well done. Warren Carroll has written quite a bit on him also in his different books of church history. His volume, The Cleaving of the Church, deals quite a bit with Charles V. He's really a central character in all of this and was kind of thrust into it, you know, it's by birth more than anything else. So I thought we'd talk about him today.
Great.
Okay. Well, Charles of Habsburg was born in 1500. And the most important thing about him right from the very beginning was his pedigree, more than anything else. His mother was Spanish. Her name was Juana, and she was a Spanish princess. She has the unfortunate nickname of Juana Loca, Juana the Crazy. And this happened very late in her life. It had to do with the death of her husband.
Okay.
And she just kind of flipped out with that. But very well placed in the Spanish royal line. When you start looking at his uncles and aunts, in other words, the brother and sisters of Juana, you can see the pedigree continue. First of all, his grandmother is Queen Isabella of Aragon.
Uh-huh.
You know, so the mother of Juana is Queen Isabella, and that of course means that his grandfather is Ferdinand. He's the king of Aragon. Isabella is queen of Castile. And then when you look at his aunts and uncle, you have Aunt Isabella, who is the queen of Portugal. Okay. And then you have Catherine, who is the queen of England.
Right.
You know, and then Uncle Juan, who died rather young, who had been married to an Austrian princess and died as a teenager.
Wow.
And it's one of those rare cases in history of a newlywed marrying and dying for, how could I say this, dying because of the marriage. He loved his wife so much that he literally neglected his own health.
Oh, my gosh.
And the honeymoon did him in, believe it or not.
Wow.
And so poor Juan died, a happy man, but a pretty young one. And so he's probably the only one of that whole group that doesn't have some kingdom behind them.
Uh-huh.
You know, so anyway, that's the mother's side of the family. On the father's side of the family,
he's the Habsburgs. Right. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. And so the relationship there is that his father is Philip of Burgundy.
Okay.
Okay. Uh-huh. And it's actually his mother, or in other words, Charles's grandmother, is the Habsburg connection.
Okay.
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 Uh-huh. And so what you have is Philip, who's nicknamed the Handsome, because evidently he was quite the dashing character. His mother, in other words, Charles's paternal grandmother, was the last heir of Burgundy. And as a result of that, he would then inherit the 17 provinces of the Netherlands, another region called the Franche-Comté. His grandfather on his father's side is Maximilian of Habsburg, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. One could only imagine the birthday presents that he'd be receiving from all of these high-powered relatives. So there he is, and at 6 years old, you know, he's rolling in on Christmas and birthdays, you can well imagine. And then his father died. So he's 6 years old.
At six.
Yeah, when Philip the Handsome died. There were ugly circumstances. The fact of the matter is that Philip was not loyal to his wife. Mm-hmm. He cheated on his wife. He considered himself to be too... Maybe that's part of the thing about being the handsome. But the long and short of it was that he was not... if I remember correctly, Juana had finally put her foot down. She knew about these little trisses, and she put her foot down and she said that she was going to expose him and that she would leave him and go back to Spain if he didn't stop this. Well, the long and short of it was that he died right after that, and she blamed herself.
Oh, no.
You know, it's one of those deals, and she just lost control of it. She would not allow him to be buried, and for weeks... The coffin stayed in the castle chapel, and it really got to be quite a thing until finally her parents sent some agents of the family up, and they brought her back to Spain, and she spent the rest of her life in a padded cell.
Wow.
You know, it's just a real, real shame. But it also means that Charles now inherits the Duchy of Burgundy, which is, of course, central south east France. Today, and he inherits that at 6 years old.
That's the thought that's just going through my mind is, okay, this boy is 6 years old.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Taking over the kingdom?
Well, he'll have a regent. Someone will help him, and he'll have a lot of help throughout his life.
He would have to.
Oh, yeah. But he's certainly being groomed. Mm-hmm. At 6 years, 16 years old, his grandfather on his mother's side, King Ferdinand, died. Mm-hmm. And with that, he now inherits his grandmother and grandfather's kingdom. So he becomes the King of Castile, the King of Aragon. Also, part of that kingdom is the city and region around Naples in Italy, basically mm-hmm. the southern half of Italy, mm-hmm. The island of Sicily, the island of Sardinia, and if that's not enough, most of the Western Hemisphere. I mean, we're talking everything from in the United States today, Florida in the east, uh-huh. and all the way across to like Arizona, Southern California, then go south. All the way through Mexico, Central America, Latin America, with the exception of Brazil, is pretty much going to be his. And so it's just an incredible... This is 16 years old.
Wow.
He's a 16-year-old kid when he inherits all of this. He's very idealistic. And at the same time... he's got a lot of things going against him. I don't know that he realized it, how many enemies he had for just being who he was. For one thing, he had the animosity of the King of France from the very beginning. This is Francis of France. He's a spoiler. But if you look at the map of Europe, you can see why he would be concerned. He is literally surrounded.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is. You know, in the east... he's got the Habsburgs, the emperor. In the west, he's got, or the southwest, he's got Spain itself, Portugal, a relative. Italy, the southern part of Italy is Charles is also. And his aunt is the Queen of England. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, things will be developing in England that are not very pretty for the Habsburgs with the divorce mm-hmm. with Henry VIII. But nonetheless, until all of that solidified, Francis is looking at himself as being, you know, pretty surrounded. And so you've got Francis I, who's going to be a lifelong enemy of Charles. And secondly, papal politics. As you change popes, some popes are going to be pro-Habsburg, others are going to be anti-Habsburg, simply, once again, because the Habsburgs are so powerful. And there's a concern that mm-hmm. you know that of that. Also, you know, quite honestly, the variety of peoples. You know, he has everything from Aztecs that look to him as their king, from Aztecs to Italians to Dutch to Spaniards, and of course, there's, you know, even within Spain there are a half dozen groups, mm-hmm. Basques and all. And so you have that. And then at the same time, too, you also have certain nationalist movements underway. This is just the beginning mm-hmm. of a sense of nationalism is uh-huh. just beginning to come about. Independence movements, all of that. And I haven't even mentioned anything about the Reformation yet.
Right.
Where does Charles get his strength? Well, a lot of times you can find that by going to a person's nightstand. What do they read before they go to bed at night? You know, uh-huh. Some people are there with their scriptures, and others take a novel or biography, whatever. What Charles did was he, every night before he went to bed, would read from a book of the Chronicles of the Burgundian nobles.
Okay.
You know, in other words, his ancestors. Mm-hmm. And these are chronicles of chivalry and honor and glory and duty. And a sense of what is referred to in these chronicles and in the life of Charles himself as the Universitas Christiana, the Christian universe, you know. And he really felt that as he was receiving more and more lands and more peoples under him, that he, and then ultimately would become the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire himself. He would be elected a little bit later on. He always, throughout his life, always referred to himself as the emperor for all Christians. Not the emperor of all Christians, mm-hmm. but the emperor for all Christians. And notice he said Christians.
Mm-hmm.
He saw himself as the leader even of those who had broken away from the church, hoping to be able to reconcile them and bring them back. In 1519, shortly after his election as the Holy Roman Emperor, his chancellor wrote the following to him, and these are the words that the chancellor had written. He said this, and Charles really believed this: God has granted you a most wonderful grace and raised you above all kings and all the princes of Christendom to a power hitherto enjoyed only by your ancestor, Charlemagne. Whoa. He, God, has set you on the way toward a world monarchy, towards a gathering of all Christendom under a single shepherd. That's kind of big stuff.
Taken.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. At the same time, too, though, Charles saw his role as the Holy Roman Emperor as being the protector of Christendom. If you remember mm-hmm. going back to the time of the schism, and it's the Emperor Sigismund that actually pulls the church together right. at the Council of Constance. And, of course, working with the Holy Father, Pope Gregory, the legitimate pope, was able to dismiss the two anti-popes, mm-hmm. remember?
Foxes.
Yeah, this is where the foxes are caught. And at the Council of Constance, Constance could not have been brought about had it not been for the role of the Holy Roman Emperor.
That's right.
And Charles sees himself in that role somewhat okay. also. Somehow he's going to have to act. The fact of the matter is that the Pope could not bring about the reconciliation of Christendom, didn't have the clout to do that. Charles saw himself as being able to do that, but of course he's not going to be able to do that without the Pope. Interestingly enough, it's going to be a series of popes. That's exactly what's going to happen, and it's going to be brought about through the Council of Trent, mm-hmm. which is a down the story a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles will play a very important role. But at the same time, you know, so early on, now, remember, he's a 19-year-old.
Okay.
Getting this word from his chancellor, calling him, you know, the greatest world monarch and all those kinds of things, that could turn somebody's head, mm-hmm. you know, too. I think probably part of the problem with the chancellor was that he had too many Crayola crayons in his box, because if he had taken a map of Charles's domain, he would have realized that there are many, many different kinds of peoples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just when you look at the political entities alone, there are at least three Spains still,
mm-hmm.
plus the multiple forms in the New World. Italy, there are at least six Italies that
wow.
he's in charge of. Remember that Italy itself does not become an entity until the 1860s. You know, there are 23 German and Rhenish entities that he's in charge of. 23. Germany doesn't become a single country, you know, remember, until 1870. Mm-hmm. So this is an incredibly complex thing. It's much more than what the chancellor gives him credit for. And even being emperor itself, the title of that is that he's the emperor of what they refer to as the Heilige Römische Reich Deutsche Nation. Okay, it's the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation.
Okay.
So even the Holy Roman Empire recognizes now that it's not the Holy Roman Empire of Charlemagne, mm-hmm. despite what this chancellor said.
Mm-hmm.
That entity itself is what we really need to be looking at, because that's the entity that will be dealing with the reformists in Germany. And to understand that, we have to understand that the emperor is elected. I think I've mentioned this before, that he's elected by seven electors. Mm-hmm. And this goes back mm-hmm. to what's known as the Golden Bull of 1356. This was a decision that was made at that time in order to stabilize the monarchy in Germany, and in order to keep the German emperor from becoming a totalitarian governing body. So there was a certain amount of a balance of power within the government. These electors, there were three who were archbishops, very prominent dioceses, Trier, Mainz, and Cologne. And we've already talked about, as we talked about Archbishop Albert, Mainz being so important as one of the electors and who's going to elect the next Holy Roman Emperor. Besides that, there are also four secular electors, the Elector of the Rhineland Palatinate, the Elector of Saxony, and the Elector of Brandenburg. And I'm leaving one out. I forgot offhand what the other one was.
And I don't have my notes from before either.
Yeah, but anyway, so there are four altogether, seven altogether, uh-huh. three of them clerical. Four of them are secular.
Uh-huh.
The key behind all of this is that the electors themselves will always be independent of the emperor, so that he cannot put pressure on them. So there's always going to be a balance of power in Germany between these and the others. There is no imperial interference in the fair elections. And that's the way it's all set up. Eventually, as time goes on, there are other noblemen in Germany that are going to get some of this power, too. The first one is going to be the Duke of Bavaria. It's a very large segment of Germany, southern Germany. The Duke of Württemberg over on the southwestern part of Germany is going to get some, too. There are two Saxonies, remember, the Electoral Saxony and then what's called Ducal Saxony, and they're going to get concessions. Hesse, the Landgrave of Hesse, is going to also become a certain independence. And then on top of that, in the late Middle Ages, and with the development of towns and cities, some 66 imperial cities are going to get independence. They're going to be known as free cities.
Oh, okay.
And so these have their own independence. Added to all of that, then you're going to have different princes and counts and margraves and freiherrs and then 70 dioceses. Each of them with a regal bishop and then abbeys on top of that. So in other words, these are bishops that themselves have independence from the emperor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Over time, certain families are going to perform certain duties for the empire, and they're going to be granted a certain
yeah.
independence.
Okay.
And there are some like 2,000 of them.
Wow.
Charles's predecessor, Maximilian, had tried to do something about this. And he tried to bring the empire together to give some kind of cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, quite honestly, it is splintered so badly.
Right.
And if it's going to be the main political force to protect For one thing, to protect Eastern Europe from the Turks
mm-hmm.
who were coming in. You had to do something about that. And so one of the things he did was he reestablished meetings of the powerful nobles of Germany in an imperial diet known as the Reichstag. And here you have now, in a sense, the beginnings of legislative or representative government in Germany. And so he introduces this and then tries to get some reforms through by introducing a tax. Now, the Germans don't like tax,
uh-huh.
and we've already seen they weren't real excited about paying crusader taxes
right.
or taxes to the papal, to the Pope. And the question of tax to the emperor was not very popular either.
Uh-huh.
His tax was only one penny.
Oh, so it's not like, okay.
Yeah, it was known as the Gemeinpfennig, the common penny. It was very, very small. But the idea was that the Germans would then get used to paying something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it didn't exactly go over because the tax collectors never collected the tax.
Because it wasn't worth it.
Yeah, it wasn't worth it, yeah.
Okay.
And besides, it was a tax, and they weren't going to do it. Well, that meant that there would be no permanent army.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't have an army. Where most countries now are beginning to put together armies, whenever the emperor needed an army, he turned to the nobles and said, "Lend me some of your troops." And they would say, "Yeah, sure," in exchange for what?
Uh-huh.
So he was always giving away more and more concessions. You had no bureaucracy in Germany. There was no imperial bureaucracy, as was developing in Spain. There is already a whole series. By the time of Ferdinand and Isabella, they've already beginning to introduce these people who are bureaucrats, who are loyal specifically to the king. They're called corregidores, and they do the king's service. In France, there's a development of a similar form called the intendant. And they're going to do the king's bidding. There's nothing like this in Germany at the time. It's not going to be until a couple centuries later that Friedrich the Great is going to do something similar to that in Prussia. But that'll only be in Prussia, and it's very unique to that. And it's a couple hundred years later. So you don't have anything like that. What you have instead is on the local level, there are going to be certain groups, individuals who will be calling the shots, and it could be a prince, or it could be a bishop, or a landgrave, or a knight, or maybe what's called a Landtag, which should be a local assembly, some kind of a body.
Mm-hmm.
Added to that, by the 1500s in Germany, there was more and more of a trend toward primogeniture. In other words, giving all of your inheritance to the oldest male in the family.
Mm-hmm.
This was an attempt then to consolidate lands, at least among the middle level lords in Germany. And when lines die out, and this happened quite often, then those lands would then revert to cousins or nephews or that sort of a thing. So the reason why we have to take a look at this background is to understand why in 1521 at the Diet of Worms, here you have a gathering, here's a diet, an imperial diet, an assembly. And remember at this point that Martin Luther is in the same shape that John Huss was at the Council of Constance.
Okay.
And yet Luther got away.
Uh-huh.
And why could Luther get away? Because the Emperor Charles V, now a 21-year-old man with all of these responsibilities, did not have the power. He had all the authority, but not the power to enforce it. He could not have arrested Luther if he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all he could do would be to persuade some of the other lords to do it. So he didn't have the power to arrest Luther. He didn't have the power to put down a revolt, which was bound to happen, which did happen. When you look at the history of the period of the Diet of Worms and the year or so that followed after, you wonder how on earth somebody like the Elector of Saxony could simply do his will against this great emperor. Once again, you have to remember that the chancellor has colored the empire in one crayon.
Right.
And that's not the way it is.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, he's got some other stuff going on and other issues, too, besides Germany. Charles is also the head of the Netherlands with its 17 provinces. Each of those provinces is semi-autonomous. Mm-hmm. Again, you have nobles that have great influence. You have consuls that of state that gather together, and each of them in their own provinces. And while Charles is supposedly the one lord that lords it over all, it's simply not so. And although he spends a lot of time in the Netherlands and is very popular among the Dutch, and he loves the Dutch very much, he recognized that it simply was not worth the fight to try to federalize, in a sense, the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And so he had to let a lot of that ride, too. The other side of his empire down in the south, in Sicily, there he's dealing with 80 different great lords. So he doesn't even try. Each of them has their own army, their own courts, their own administrators. And what he does is he sends down a Spaniard to act as the vice king. The Spanish term for it is viceroy. That's where we get the term, viceroy.
Okay.
And so he becomes the viceroy of Sicily, and basically the one thing he has to have is negotiation skills, just constantly negotiating. Mm-hmm. Once again, a lot of authority, but no power. Mm-hmm. It's really in the Spanish area that Charles will have his wealth and his power, as well as his authority. And already early on in 1522, he recognizes this and begins transferring more and more of his Austrian holdings and his German duties over to his younger brother.
Oh, okay.
And this is the Archduke Ferdinand.
Okay.
So Archduke, he's the top duke of, mm-hmm. of all of the dukes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Eventually, he'll become the emperor, the next emperor himself.
Okay.
And more than Charles spends more time dealing with Spain and the questions of Spain. Here, then, he truly has a global perspective because he's not only in just Europe, but his concerns are also dealing with the New World. I'd like to talk a little bit about the New World and what's going on there, and then shift back over because he's going to be challanged also globally by the Turks and by mm-hmm. Islam. And mm-hmm. so there's that whole chapter of his life, too. Well, in the Western Hemisphere, you know that that you have the conquests that take place mm-hmm. In Mexico in the late 1520s. By 1529, Mexico is conquered. It's got like 12, 14 million people in it. And the very first question that that Charles has is that these people are so different from us, language, religion, culture, the whole world. Where did they come from? They didn't obviously come from any European country. And the first question he asked seems to be very naive, but at least he asked it. And the question was, are these in fact human beings?
Oh, my gosh.
And in fact, if they are human beings, do they have souls? And so he turns to a group of experts in Spain, and they study. These are theologians and philosophers and anthropologists, and they study the question. They study everything they know of these the civilization, and they come back to the emperor and say, yes, they are human beings, and yes, they do have immortal souls. And then his sort of a light, you know, comes on in his brain, and he goes, then I've got a responsibility to bring the gospel to these people, to baptize them, you know, go forth and baptize,
uh-huh.
you know, the whole.
Wow.
And so he takes that as a serious challenge. And here we have then, for instance, the establishment, as we've talked about many times before, of the city of Puebla, with the intention of using Thomas More, St. Thomas More's book, Utopia, as the model mm-hmm. for this city. This is going to be very, very hard to do because it's so far away and ugly things are going to happen. But every time Charles is confronted with the ugly events and actions of his viceroys and his governors in New Spain, in the New World, he will always try to rectify what they did wrong.
Okay.
He is an honorable man.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the reasons why Warren Carroll and Carl Brandy and so many of the other biographers have such a high opinion of him,
uh-huh.
because he deserves it. You know, you have these, you know, the conquistadors,
mm-hmm.
as we've already seen that, and how they were motivated by gold, glory, and the gospel.
Right.
I am convinced that as you look at that in those three aspects, that the vast majority of them were motivated, number one, by glory. That was the number one thing. And then by the gospel, and then by gold.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And I think that Hernando Cortez is the best example of that, especially in Mexico. Here is a man who made a fortune off of the conquest of Mexico,
uh-huh.
and he turned around and he gave it all away in order to go out and get more glory.
Wow.
Here is a man that on several occasions, when you look at the conquest of Mexico and the way in which it was done, from the landing at Veracruz all the way to the taking of Mexico City,
mm-hmm.
its loss and taking again, time after time, he paused in order to preach the gospel to the people and to bring the message of Jesus Christ to the people. Here is a man who, after he becomes this incredible conquistador over this huge empire, what is the first thing he does when he sends a letter back to the Emperor Charles V? He says, "I need help. Send me Franciscans." You know, not soldiers,
right.
Franciscans. 12 Franciscans arrive. They travel the same route that he had taken. When they arrive in Mexico City, the Aztecs get an eyeful when this conqueror of all of the empire goes out to the Franciscans, who are simple monks who probably smell pretty bad having walked all that way, discalced. They're not wearing shoes. And he kneels down to them. You know, he's kneeling to them. I just, you know, you have to look at this guy differently. He's not motivated out of money. He could have made a fortune and retired to some big villa back in
mm-hmm.
Spain. Didn't do that, you know. And I think you find that on many cases. Unfortunately, it's not true of everyone.
Sure.
You know, but every time that you do have these cases, like I say, when it gets back to Charles, Charles rectifies it. What he does is he'll divide this vast region into four divisions, which he names, first of all, Panama,
mm-hmm.
Guatemala, and then New Spain, which will be Mexico and Florida itself. And he gives that area over to a most unfortunate decision. He makes viceroy of New Spain, which is, I say, Mexico and Florida. He gives to Antonio de Guzman. This is a man who, despite the findings of that commission, that these natives are human beings and they have souls, he treats them as cattle,
mm.
and he denies the fact that they have souls. Argues that he will cross swords in a metaphorical sense with the bishop of Mexico City. Bishop Juan Zumárraga, who will stand against him and ultimately write a letter back to Spain explaining what the Guzman was doing. I mean, he was branding people, branding them, you know, and treating them like slaves, enslaving them. And Bishop Zumárraga writes back to the emperor, lets him know what's going on. And of course, you know, transportation takes so long,
right.
Communication takes so long. But by the time the return mail got back, de Guzman was arrested and sent back to Spain and tried for these inhuman acts and went to prison for it. You know, this Bishop Zumarraga is, of course, also...
Do you recognize that name?
Yes, that's for sure. He's the recipient of that wonderful gift from Juan Diego, mm-hmm. The tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Right.
So these are just wonderful events taking place. Also, the fourth, I mentioned three.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Was yeah, the fourth is Santo Domingo, which is basically the Caribbean region itself. Then there's going to be an extension down into South America, especially along the Pacific coast. You'll have the establishment on the Pacific coast of what they refer to as Little Venice, Venezuela.
Oh my gosh! Okay.
Little Venice, and they call it Little Venice because it was a little port
uh-huh.
with lots of canals
okay.
in it. And so this area is then going to be taken over by the Spanish. It'll be financed by the Fugger Bank in Germany.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And eventually some 24 German miners are going to be hired. They're going to leave a valley in what is today the Yugoslavian region. They're going to be sent to Venezuela in order to begin mining operations.
Mm-hmm.
And along with that, an unfortunate moment in history, some 4,000 African slaves will also be shipped over to that area. The way that we'll look at this some other time, but the way that the Spanish treated their slaves is far different from the way that Americans treated their slaves in the south part of the United States. Once again, it was assumed that these were people who had souls
mm-hmm.
and would be baptized. Certainly the incredible work of people like St. Peter Claver
mm-hmm.
in baptizing and converting these slaves and then protecting them afterwards is a long story. Certainly Martin de Porres,
mm-hmm.
Rose of Lima. This is a moment
wow.
of great sainthood out of this new continent. Another really fast and interesting story is that these miners had been in a valley, working in a valley called St. Joachimsthal, St. James Valley.
Okay.
And the coins that they mined, the gold that they mined and silver, they would then cast into coins right away. And they used to be known as St. Joachimsthaler. Okay,
okay.
That's too long. And mm-hmm. so what they did was they simply cut off the first part and called them tallers, which, of course, we call
dollars.
That's where we get the word dollar.
Hmm.
Kind of a little fun fact.
That's interesting.
Isn't it? Yeah. You have, of course, the conquest of Panama and of Peru by Francisco Pizarro, who is not one of the shining stars in all of the Spanish Empire. But once again, the conquest takes place in 1533. It's in 1535 that Charles receives the first reports of this conquest.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the reports were purged of any description of the way in which Pizarro had conquered Cuzco.
Right.
So Charles had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
You can read the reports. They're there in archives, and they talk about the fabulous gold and the wealth and everything, but they don't say anything about the terrible way in which he had conquered all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Closer to home, Charles had a real problem on his hands, and that was all along the southern coast of Spain and all across North Africa. You have a large population of Muslims. Now, if you remember, in 1492, his grandparents had conquered Granada, which was the last holdout of Islam in Spain. This is the end of a thousand-year reconquista that had taken place. Remember that the Muslims had invaded in the 700s up into
mm-hmm.
Spain, conquered all of Spain, and even got into France at the Battle of Tours. Of course, they were turned back by Charles Martel and the knights.
Uh-huh.
And then over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, the slow reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula. And this is all completed in 1492. And then that, okay, fine. And then Spain is declared a Catholic nation, and Jews and Moors, Muslim Spaniards, were invited to be converted to Catholicism. If they failed to do that, they were given a certain amount of time to leave, and many of them were expelled and, of course, sent down into North Africa. Mm-hmm. It was a tremendous change of peoples. But the fact of the matter is that not everyone who converted took that conversion seriously. Mm-hmm. And there's a big controversy among Jewish Spaniards, and known as the conversos, those who converted, but only in name, only. Mm-hmm. And then this is also true among the Moors. There's a whole group of people known as the Moriscos, and these are people who had converted in name only but remained loyal to Islam. Many of these acted as a fifth column along the Spanish coastline, in which they would give aid and information to Islamic pirates.
Okay, to carry back.
Yeah, and I can't tell you the number of Catholic communities that were slaughtered by these pirates coming in. I mean, talk about 16th century terrorism.
Wow.
This was a real problem. There's one point at which the Moors thought that they finally were able to make a comeback. They brought in a lot of pirates. They had a leader. The Muslim forces had a leader by the name of Barbarossa, the Red Beard, mm-hmm. Who was one of these old sea salt characters, and a Turkish fleet. And there was an uprising in parts of Spain where there were still a lot of these Moriscos. Something like 10,000 Christians were slaughtered in this uprising. 10,000 were slaughtered in this uprising. Interestingly enough, when this was all put down, Karl Brandy talks about this. This is one of the finer moments of Charles V. When the rebellion is put down and all the people who had rebelled were captured,
mm-hmm.
instead of slaughtering them, as one might think that you might do.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what he did was he took all of the families of these Moriscos and he moved them away from the coast into the central regions, the northern central regions, farming land of Spain, gave them farms.
Wow.
Isn't that something? Gave them farms, gave them education, put up schools, put up libraries, and instead of killing them, tried to change their hearts.
Mm-hmm.
That's an incredible moment in history.
Certainly.
You could do that. But this doesn't take away from the fact that Christendom was under incredible attack. And what was happening down in Spain seemed to be very much part of a double pincer movement, organized or unorganized, by the Ottoman Turks. Because at the same time they were attacking in Spain, using their navy, they also were attacking in the eastern part of Europe, coming into Serbia and into the Balkans region, conquering all of that, eventually working their way all the way up the Danube River, taking over Hungary, even attacking Vienna itself. And so this is a tremendous attack. Charles is standing by himself in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he, on the one hand, his own brother, the Archduke Ferdinand, even made peace with the Turks because he didn't have the power to fight them. Remember, he doesn't have an army. It's that
mm-hmm.
same old problem mm-hmm. the Holy Roman Emperor had.
Even
the Pope, Clement VII, went back and forth. Charles could never count on Clement VII because Clement VII didn't entirely trust Charles, and he would play Francis I of France against Charles, so he couldn't even count on the Pope. There was a terrible incident in 1527 when one of Charles's armies got too close to the city of Rome. They were doing some marching from one point to another. Many of the members of Charles's German imperial army were actually German Protestants, and when they got within striking distance of Rome, they disobeyed their officers and ran into the city of Rome and sacked it.
Oh,
sacking is an ugly thing. I mean, they simply took over the city, drunkenness, murder, rape, the whole work. It went on for days. And it was just a terrible event. Nobody in the Imperial Army had control over these soldiers. By the time they finally got control over them and moved them out of the city was a shambles. Mm. And it was just a mess. The one thing, the one good thing that came out of it was many members of the Curia had been so shaken that they believed that this was God's wrath for them not reforming the church fast and hard enough. And some of these men who had been more interested in their lavish lifestyle became very concerned about working on reforming the church. And they'll become some of the allies of later popes to call together a council to reform the church. At one point, in fact, when Charles put together a Christian fleet in order to counter this Turkish fleet in the western Mediterranean, he conquered one of the cities, and then in the city of Tunis in Tunisia, and breaking in finally after he's victorious with all of that, he discovered that the Turks had cannon that had been manufactured in France. Got the goods on Francis the First in that one.
Wow. Wasn't concerned about the Turks?
No, he saw the Turks as allies. This, king of the eldest daughter of the church saw the Turks as allies. Why? Because they were attacking the the Habsburg Empire.
They were,
Whoa.
Pride is a scary thing, isn't it?
Yeah. It's after that successful conquest that Charles goes to Italy, and there he meets with Pope Paul III. Pope Paul III has been trying to reform the church, first of all, in his own diocese, and he's done that. He is a reforming pope. He wants to have a council. He wants to move in those directions, but he's being stymied by a lot of his own cardinals who are slow dancing the affair and trying to keep that from happening. So what he does is Pope Paul III begins appointing new cardinals, and what he does is he begins appointing lay cardinals who are very learned scripture scholars and experts in patristics. And in a sense, he's sort of doing an end run around the cardinals. It's going to set things up so that eventually there is going to be a council called, the Council of Mantua. It's a failure. Nobody comes. We'll have to wait for another council after that. There's another brief war between Charles and Francis. He is at first successful, but in the end is not able to push Francis into surrendering. A treaty is signed. Not much comes of it. He turns his attention again to the Pope, Paul III. The Pope calls the Council of Mantua, and as I say, nobody comes. Later on, we'll talk about another war that takes place up in Germany, the Schmalkaldic War, in which it truly is a religious war between Catholics and Lutherans, mainly. And that really breaks the spirit of this emperor for the Christians. In 1555, then, at the end of that war, Charles announces his own abdication. He realizes that here, he's only 55 years old, but he realizes that he cannot solve this, and he leaves it to the next generation. He turns over all of the German concerns to his brother, the Archduke Ferdinand, who becomes the next emperor. He, at the same time, turns over the rest of the world, basically, to his son, Philip II, who then becomes, King of Spain and emperor of so much in the West, or the king of the Western Hemisphere. The Philippines are named after him. Charles then goes to a monastery. His wife had died a couple years earlier, and in, I believe it was 1556, late 56 or maybe early 57, he himself becomes mortally ill after spending several months with the monks praying, doing penance, studying, preparing for his last journey, his last adventure, and then quietly passes away in a monastery room, clutching a picture of his wife.
Oh, wow.
It's a beautiful,
isn't it? Life.
Yeah, it really is.
He probably felt like he failed, but he'd done so much.
Yeah, I think that's
true. I hope
he
realized what he accomplished.
Well, I think maybe looking down from heaven, he would, but that certainly...
Better view.
Yeah, I think that probably he would have died with a sense that he was much like those Burgundian ancestors
mm-hmm.
of his.
That he read about.
Yeah, courage and chivalry and honesty and all the other knightly virtues. He was a man that lived that. He was a man who was an emperor for Christians. Uh-huh. Really was.
What a great story, Father.
Oh,
thank
what
you.
A great life.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We could use more leaders.
Oh, isn't that for sure? Yeah.
Well, shall we close today?
Let's do. Why don't we pray that great prayer, that doxology, but maybe with a special intention on this day as the bishops are gathering here in St. Louis.
Yeah.
For this meeting, we just ask God to send His Holy Spirit among them to inspire them, to give them the wisdom that they need to lead the church in America at this time, and also the zeal and the courage to do the right things. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was
in the beginning,
is now,
and ever
shall
be.
A world without end. Amen.